Thank you so much for your time, Nazir. It is a genuine honour and pleasure to have with us here today one of the most established financiers, bankers and investors in the entirety of ASEAN. You're watching the Oxford Political Review. I'm Brian Wong, the founder of the review, and we're so honoured to have in our presence Nazir Razak. So thank you so much for your time.
Pleasure, man.
So I want to just start off with a question about ASEAN, which, as you know, is an incredibly complex and heterogeneous entity with many forces pulling in different directions. And I know you're a massive, you know, advocate of sensible, measured integration within ASEAN, and yet over recent years, especially in light of what's been going on in terms of Sino-American tensions, there's been a geopolitical fault lines emerging even amongst the members within ASEAN, or alternatively, it's not clear if the economic complementarity necessarily always works out such that these members' strengths and weaknesses complement one another as opposed to rivaling or competing with one another. So in short, there are impediments and there are structural barriers, as it seems, to greater integration within ASEAN. You've previously remarked that it was smart that ASEAN decided to dial back on the rhetoric concerning a shared single production base and instead opted for more realizable goals in the short to medium term with respect to its integration plans. Do you think that, you know, ASEAN integration is likely to continue across economic, financial, and also social political spheres, or do you see this as coming to an end for now?
No, I think the most important thing to remember about ASEAN is what it has achieved as a political force. Yeah, if you recall, ASEAN came together in 1967, just after the confrontasi between Malaysia and Indonesia, and you know, later on, we after the Vietnam War, we included North ASEAN, and you know, since then, we've been pretty much at peace. Yeah, and peace and stability has been the kind of bedrock of growth and development. So we must never forget that ASEAN did that for us. And then we want ASEAN to do more. So we talked about the ASEAN economic integration. And there are lots of good things that can be done if we come together and integrate. But you know, it is not easy. And you know, in some respects, you know, we kind of got overexcited about it, just like Europe and etc. Because the reality of economic integration is that you do constrain domestic policies, and that's just not acceptable. And for ASEAN to then also go further and kind of become, for us to become ASEANites, it's also very difficult. We're all fledgling new states. Yeah. So I think it's good that we kind of tempered our ambitions. But I think we need to make sure that ASEAN continues as a political coalition, and I think it will. It will go through challenging times, no doubt, with this new bipolar world, with you know, North ASEAN and its linkages with China. And kind of Singapore, Indonesia with strong linkages with the US and so on. But it's very, very important that we stick together because collectively we have a voice. Individually, we're tiny. Yeah. In terms of economic integration, I just feel that there's more that we can do. I think that the kind of total single production-based agenda, etc., was too ambitious. But I think that in terms of integrating, there's much more we can do if we are more methodical in how we integrate economies. One of my criticisms of the process is very much dependent or very much led by the bureaucrats in the ASEAN secretariat. And you know, ASEAN in some ways was always kept very weak as a secretariat, and you saw that from the beginning. And our leaders wanted to come together. Essentially, we come together as a group, but once we come together, it's more of an external face. Internally, we don't disturb each other.
Yeah.
So therefore, ASEAN secretariat is very light. And that lightness is a huge impediment when you go into details of economic integration. So what I think is important is to find a way where the ASEAN sector and private sector come together and look at ways where you know, trade can be freer, processes can be easier between countries. And you can go sector by sector. You need to go sector by sector to be effective.
Do you think the lightness there of the secretariat is a cause of the difficulties or symptom of the difficulties? Because as I see it, for instance, taking, you know, the Sino-US interactions, for instance, North ASEAN in the form of Cambodia, Laos, and increasingly Myanmar. Well, obviously, with the current situation with the Tatmadaw and the junta, that's another story. You've got one cluster there. And you also have Indonesia, you've got the Philippines and Singapore as well. And then Malaysia sits in this unique position almost, where it has, you know, increasing economic presence coming from China, but also very much traditionally and historically robust ties with the Western liberal democratic world, where the founding father, of course, of Malaysia, with his vision, his attempts to transform Malaysian society in the aftermath of colonial rule, has often been cast, as you discussed in your book, in a light that frames him as a pro-West or favourable towards the Western liberal ideals figure. So in light of this, I guess the question I have for you, Nazira, is where do you see Malaysia in all of this? Do you see Malaysia as a balancer, as a hedger, or as a mediator between these blocks?
We are definitely the balancer in the middle, geographically, as well as, you know, I think philosophically or ideologically, we are the balancer. Malaysia was the first country to open diplomatic relations to China. But at the same time, the leaders who opened those diplomatic relations were British educated and, you know, Western in their outlook. So today we talk very easily to both sides. And with our Islamic credentials, we're also very well linked to the Middle East. And of course, with the diaspora, we're also very linked to India and China. So Malaysia is in a great place to kind of be the bridge for everybody. And we've seen this in the past where the Malaysian Wisma Putra or Foreign Service has really done a very good job in kind of bridging or kind of toning down tensions between different countries in ASEAN.
Is that mediating role still tenable though, in light of basically what we see right now where China is advancing this view of sort of the Belt and Road Initiative, an alternative, some say, and some others say, a supplementary or complement to the existing order on one hand, whereas America says, actually, you know, it's high time that America is back to Asia and back to the Indo-Pacific in relation to, of course, ensuring or seeing to that America has a foothold within this particular sphere of the world. So is the balancing function still tenable, given these tensions and given these, you know, non-convergent strategic objectives?
Well, that is a big question. I'm not sure if I'm the best person to answer. I think certainly on Malaysia's part, I would imagine that if you ask our leaders, they would say there is absolutely no benefit from us being on either side. Yeah, we are best neutral, keeping the bridge between them, and also more importantly keeping ASEAN together as a kind of balancing force. I think, you know, in terms of the bipolar world and, you know, the silence trap and so on, all those arguments will be made. I don't really know, that's beyond my pay grade to predict that.
Yeah.
But I do think that, you know, in this interdependent world there's more to gain if we collaborate, and I think, you know, the US just needs to find a way to understand that, you know, China is now a very big economy, bigger and soon bigger than the US, and it needs to be accommodated at the head end.
I want to situate this in the context of finance, because I know sort of you obviously speak from a wealth of voluminous experience in finance and also financial dealings between corporations, between banks and countries. In the aftermath of the Russian war in Ukraine, we've seen effectively the imposition of sanctions, the kicking out of Russia from SWIFT, and increasing talk of financial decoupling and securitization of interest on the flip side to that, in both China and Russia, in reaction to what they see as effectively the West is leveraging, or the employment of financial systems and tools to achieve geopolitical objectives and goals. In the face of these pressures, what do you make of the claim, Nazir, that we're heading towards an era of some degree of deglobalization or rollback to globalization and financial decoupling, you know, which had been previously so unimaginable for decades, right? Especially since the late 1980s. For once in, say, 40 years, it's an option on the table. It may not be a desirable option, but it's certainly an option that's been touted. And I guess, what do you make of this claim or view, and are you worried about it?
I am, but in some ways, you know, we had become too interconnected. And I think that we learned through various crises that the world had become too interconnected, and some of us were already wondering how to come up with some kind of ring fencing. And you know, Malaysia during the Asian financial crisis introduced capital controls to kind of insulate itself. And then we were hammered for introducing capital controls by, you know, the conventional economists in the West. Right, and then what happens in the global financial crisis, they do exactly the same.
Yeah,
they freeze short selling, etc. Yeah. Right, and so that kind of hypocrisy was also quite annoying. And I think, you know, in many ways, the global financial crisis proved that the kind of Western integrated, total free market system needed to be reformed, and some the smaller countries needed to find its own guardrails against those excesses. Just think of sheer volume of how capital can come in and out of a country at that speed. You can destroy a country, and some countries have been destroyed. So one needs to evolve global finance accordingly. I think we've kind of bowed too much to the interests of financiers making lots of money, and we should think about the real value that finance brings to the real economy, and how you allow finance to play a positive role, but you don't allow it to damage economies.
Absolutely, and on that note, actually, I wanted to draw your attention to a chapter which I really enjoyed in your book, What's in a Name, where you spoke of exactly sort of the different responses to the AFC, the Asian Financial Crisis in 1997 between Malaysia, I guess, and Thailand, and also Hong Kong, where I suppose Hong Kong adopted a rather different approach entirely to Malaysia's capital control-centered response, where there was instead an active attempt to match and basically to cover, and there was a gambit on a part of the Hong Kong authorities, for instance, the HKMA, or rather before that, its predecessor, in seeking to hold off against those who were shorting and seeking to undermine the Hong Kong dollar and whatnot. So I guess the question I want to ask here is, how did the different political structures or institutions across Asian states back then in 1997, in your view, give rise to these differentiated financial and economic responses by the governments to the crisis?
Well, I think the responses were kind of driven by your balance sheets, your capacities, different capacities. And Malaysia did not have large foreign borrowings, and that was the most important thing that allowed Malaysia to kind of choose its own path and ultimately choose capital controls. Whereas Indonesia were hammered because of the sheer size of its foreign borrowings, right? And then it had to turn to the IMF and bow to the IMF policies. One's own financial position was the big determinant. Two, I guess, in terms of the politics, in the end of the day, Malaysia, we did, Mahathir, one of the drivers of kind of insulating Malaysia is to resist political change. There was definitely a motive to avoid political change, because clearly in those situations the challengers see opportunity, they smell blood, and they were already moving against Mahathir when he decided to kind of shut down the economy and take his own make his own political defense.
How much of that political factor of that fear of effectively opponents and whatnot seizing upon crises as a means of engendering political change, how much of that do you think was essentially at play here in relation to the debacle over the MCO and also the earlier days of Malaysia's handling of the pandemic, which overarchingly I would say has been rather successful, actually, objectively, on paper at least. But in the earlier days, there was criticism that, you know, the Mujahideen administration overplayed its hands, and then there was a perception that his opponents were using the crisis as an opportunity to force him out. Do you agree with that hypothesis, or do you think the analogizability is limited between 97 and 21?
No, I think it's limited, very different. Okay. Circumstances. Malaysia's handling of the MCO, there was this whole political dynamics of dethroning the PH government. And that was done, although COVID had started, we just ignored COVID. To our detriment, right? We ignored COVID, we played politics instead. And then once politics settled, then we paid our attention to COVID. Unfortunately, at some cost.
And it is on that note that I want to pivot our discussion towards Malaysian politics, which is the second segment of our conversation today. So in an earlier or recent interview, actually, Nazir, you said, Malaysia is not a failed state, but it is a nation in decline, or at least that's the translation of it, online. And I wanted to ask you a question on that front, which is essentially, might Malaysia not be not really one nation, but actually multiple nations in one? Because nation, if we take, you know, Anderson's conception of it as an imagined community, or sort of the theory or theorization of it as anchored around a shared ethnic identity or a shared basis for association. Obviously, in an ideal world, we practice civic nationalism. It's a values-based nationalism. But in practice, it strikes me that what Malaysia is seeing these days is not so much coexistence between different nations under one overarching national banner, but that you see increasingly, you know, the steering of politics by different forms of nationalism. You've got Malay nationalism, Chinese nationalism, and increasingly the disillusionment of those who are neither Malay nor Chinese in this country. And I know in your book you've criticised how the NEP, as established by your father, has now degenerated effectively into a shell of its former self in many institutions and many areas where it's been abused and maladopted. Do you see Malaysia's ethnic tensions and sectarian divisions as coming to a boiling point anytime soon? And are we, you know, witnessing greater fragmentation as a result of that?
No, I think my view is that Malaysians have been living together but growing apart for a number of years. And in my book, I talk about this three-headed monster. One of it is identity politics. The NEP identity politics have kind of come together and, you know, and kind of accentuated the divide so much so that it undermines the making of Malaysia project. I mean, at independence, we recognized that there was a nation to be built. Right? It is the formation of a Malay nation and a Malaysian nation. That's the aspiration, and that aspiration remains today. But when you look at the trajectory, actually we move further away from that ultimate goal. Does that mean that we're going to beat each other up soon? No, I don't think so. I don't think the situation is combustible that way on ethnic lines. I don't. I think that you know, the demographic change also. Is such that this country is going to be about 70-75% Malays. We will have a dominant race. We're pretty much getting there. So the minorities will generally have to adjust, as do the majority, to that reality. Mm. It is basically a Malay-dominated society. And I think that we need to then organize our politics in such a way that the minorities are fairly treated. I think the minorities, if they are unfairly treated, I don't think it's a case that there will be fights in the streets. I think with those numbers, I think they'll just vote with their feet and they'll go elsewhere. They'll work elsewhere. And we don't want that. Mm. I believe in the power of diversity. I believe this nation is richer. Much richer because of its mix of cultures and ethnicities, and so on. What I believe we should get back to is this Bangsa Malaysia project, mm-hmm. or Malaysian Nation project, yeah. Which I think is forgotten. We had these national principles of Rukun Negara, that we launched in 1970, and that's a very powerful document, but it's kind of fallen by the wayside. And so, you know, part of my reform agenda is to go back to the tenets of Rukun Negara and focus on rebuilding or building a nation. And, you know, there are a lot of aspects to it, in particular education. You can't build a nation when your children go to school separately. You just cannot. That needs to be changed. But the very people who advocate Malaysian are also very resistant to the, you know, end of vernacular schools. So there are deals to be negotiated.
And that brings me on to the worry concerning the feasibility of the proposal, because I when I was reading your book, I very much agreed with your vision and ideals, and I think in many ways it's reminiscent of a more accommodative and pluralist conception of the Malaysian nation that the founding fathers of this country touted and expressed. And it's not dissimilar to what Nehru envisioned to be essentially sort of India's organising tenet and principle and Congress and whatnot. But I guess the question that faces and confronts both those who want to push back against ethnic nationalism, and I raised this with Dr. Shashith Rao recently, actually, at his book talk as well, it's hard. It's very difficult when the very nation builders and organizers in the nation today, those who decide upon educational policies, the vernacular, the adoption of languages, are also those who are very much reluctant to and resistant towards building a Bangsar Malaysia or a Bangsar project, and instead are opting for the easy way out, which is invoking and driving up really ethnic or ethnocentric sentiments in order to achieve their own political end. So what's the way out of this impasse? Or is it just that we know there's a right solution, we're not going to get there though because of these constraints?
Yeah, so what I'm advocating is deliberative democracy. I think many countries have turned to deliberative democracy or citizens' assemblies to kind of deliberate the way forward.
Mm.
Right? And I do think that the problem is what you say, which is the politicians, right? You want to win a political game, you outbid each other based on identity,
yeah.
Right? Period. And that's the simplest way to win. And we need to have a platform away from the politicians and electioneering, etc., where people can really constructively deliberate what is the best way forward for the nation. Once that package is then agreed upon, then you put it out there for then the politicians to, you know, to come back and run the country and debate in parliament. But to go from what we are today, which is a system that is broken, to a system that is workable again, that we need to go offline.
Absolutely. And I think what's interesting here is essentially on the viability of deliberative democracy, because the criticisms that often are mounted against sort of Ackerman and Josh Cohen and their works on deliberative democracy is that it ends up being implicitly exclusionary, because it is not the case that those who are, you know, most able to rock up to these discussions are also those who most necessarily need them. So for instance, if you're a labourer, if you're someone who struggles, you're someone who's poor, you're trying to put food on the table, you won't rock up to town halls. Or if you're someone who already harbours innate, deeply rooted disillusionment and scepticism towards the system, very much like the Gilets Jaunes protesters and Emmanuel Macron in France, you're not going to rock up to the sort of 3,650 town halls that he and his mayors across France scheduled, as much as they're, you know, well-intentioned and come with ultimately just objectives in my view. So I guess the question here is, deliberation's great, but you also want to ensure that the barriers to entry are as low as possible. Is that feasible? Is that realistic?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you don't want to, you want to go through some process of sortition.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you want to ensure diversity, and you want to be pragmatic. You don't want someone who, you know, can't spare the time, and so on to do it. So I think it's fine. What we don't want is a bunch of elites,
yes,
and intellectuals. I think somewhere in between, it's been done in many countries. I think it's very, very doable.
And actually, it is on that front that I was also pondering, you know, when it comes to Malaysia moving forward, reconciling, bridging the gap and divides. Obviously, the elephant in the room for both the ruling party and also the country at large is, by and large, sort of your brother and Najib's recent or the political turmoil and the controversy surrounding him. Do you think Malaysia as a country is ready to move on and is prepared to move on from the contentions there?
Malaysia is moving on. I think that this, there's a general election coming, and you know, I think the electorate is from the recent state elections. The electorate are kind of moving on quite clearly. They're voting for policies. They're voting for stability rather than getting drawn in by. Sloganeering like one MDP, all that is done and dusted, I think. So Malaysian politics going forwards is going to be quite uncertain.
Because it's seeking to find a new cleavage, presumably, and a new issue around which it can organise itself.
Well, yeah, and you know, we always assume that this GE14 or whatever.
GE15.
G14 and the fall of Barisan was a great moment for democracy, but there's never an assurance that what replaces it is a better system. We need to work to a better system, right? Are we going to get a two-party system? A two-party system in a plural society like ours, is it going to be contested based on identity or issues? Right? So there are a lot of things to work through, and people who assume that, because BN is no longer the dominant party, that is a good thing. I'm making huge assumptions.
We're going into GE15 probably within the next 30 to 45 days, I suppose, or maybe 2 months, I guess.
That's great.
What are your predictions for this particular election?
Well, I think it all depends on the what the competition looks like. As it stands today, you've got BN versus others, and based on the state elections, you could get you know, BN used to win 50 to 60% of the votes and form government. Today, it could win 40% of the votes and form government because the opposition is so splintered in this first past the post system. That's the most likely scenario now. But you could imagine, you know, that the opposition kind of pull together, and maybe they'll do that in the last few weeks or few months. Then the results could be quite different. Because if the 60% get together, then
absolutely. But it doesn't strike me as that 60% getting together possibility is all that likely, given the internal mistrust and divides that
that
persist.
Necessity is the mother of invention. You never know.
That's very fair. So I want to now turn to the final segment of our interview today, which is about the more personal dimensions and aspects of your story, which I find incredibly fascinating. Whilst reading through the pages and flicking through the pages of your excellent memoir biography, What's in a Name, which I would strongly and thoroughly recommend. And one of the questions I wanted to ask you on that is, you've positioned yourself since sort of your retirement from a more active role in CMIB. Since then, you've positioned yourself as a rather objective, you know, commentator, thinker, critic, and intellectual. And I think this is also a brand and a reputation that you've cultivated, not just through the recent years, but also throughout all these decades of you basically putting your foot where your mouth is and doing and seeking to change Malaysian society for the better through finance, and public finance in particular. I was wondering on that front, though, have you ever considered taking one step, two steps further into the political scene in jumping into the arena? Or is it, as you said in your interview with Nairi Woods earlier this year in January, the case that you prefer to change Malaysia through your current positions and your current capacities?
Yeah, I think we all have our roles. And, one's role is based on what, you feel your best at. And just like this whole idea of a better Malaysia assembly and so on, it's not even a movement. It is an idea that we, 55 of us, wrote a letter to the king. It's an idea, and we're hoping that the institutions and the political parties take it up. So I'm not a political movement in any way. Have I thought about going to politics? Of course. That's a natural thing to do when you come from a political family. Do I think I would be a good politician? Not in this system. And I think that if I go into politics, I would have to, sooner or later, dance to the tune of the current system. And I worry that dancing to the tune of the current system will kind of compromise me in a way that undermines my ultimate agenda, which is to change politics. And I think maybe changing politics is more doable as an independent, right? Without taking any sides. I'm just an independent voice, and I put Better Malaysia Assembly out there. A few political parties are already going to take it up. And if enough take it up, they form government, and I'm happy to come in and do the work for them. You know, I think I was thinking about it. I mean, in the end of the day, what? You know, you want to make you work to make a difference. You don't work to have a position. I don't need that position. I'd rather look back and say that, okay, I helped make a better Malaysia in my own way, if I helped with the democracy, or I helped with making change, making politics more sensible or whatever. I'd be happy with that. I'd rather do that than look back and at myself as having been a prime minister who had to compromise and ended up to be a bad prime minister. I'd rather the former rather than the latter.
I think that's a very reasonable sentiment, although I guess one pushback that you might face is the school of thought that says, if you don't get your hands dirty, if you don't compromise, given that politics is about compromising, then you'll never gain the true levers of power in transforming the way the structures are built. So I guess that's a sort of dirty hands pushback you might get.
No, that's fair. And, as I said, at the moment, I think that, someone needs to come up with the idea. Someone needs to do the thinking. I just need to find the people to do the politicking based on my thinking.
Are you worried that Malaysian politics is intrinsically built to be devoid of ideas? And I raise here a historical example, which is essentially going back to the undergirding ethos for the Bumiputera policy. It's a form of affirmative action to correct for structural imbalances and injustices that disadvantaged back then and still have since then ethnic Malays. So the underlying ethos is noble. It is a vision of ultimately transforming politics to be more egalitarian as the end outcome, more fair, more just. And yet, as you've pointed out in your book, the NEP, as espoused and envisioned by your father, has since become co-opted, especially in the aftermath of his passing, by vested interests, by those with ulterior motives, into becoming this vessel for their own personal ambition. So the worry here is that the ideas are great and they're wonderful, they're truly instrumental, but the practice and the implementation of that, not only does it affect, it actually kills the idea. So it throws the baby out alongside the bathwater.
No, I agree. I agree, there's always a risk of that. There's always a risk of that. But, as I said, the flip is, I could go in, I could do the take on the dirty work, and end of the day, I may lose the credibility to pursue the idea as well.
And on that note of credibility, to what extent do you see, because some say, right, you're publishing this book is your attempt to build a second career or a third career in supporting your development of political credibility, whereas others say, having read your book, you should be the Prime Minister of this country. You should take it one step further, two steps further. Very clearly, the people like you and the people need you in many respects, not just because of your ideas, but also because of your expertise, your knowledge, your acumen. And I don't want to sort of sound like a fanboy here, Nazir, but I guess in face of these popular demands and also folks who believe very firmly in your ideas, what would be your sort of overarching recommendation for them in face of GE15? How should they vote? Should they vote? Is voting that important? Or is it instead about changing the systems from the outside? So voting is just, at the end of the day, merely one part of many steps towards reforming change.
No, I think GE15 is imminent. And one should basically vote for, in our system, you've got to vote for the candidates.
Mm.
Yeah, vote for the credible candidates. And in terms of parties, I think, you know, vote for parties that are going to advocate positive politics. Like, you know, some parties will advocate citizens' assemblies, and I would be, you know, supportive of them. I think that I think this is a very important election, a very, very important election. I think that we run a risk of going back to the past. And there are many ways that this, even if BN wins, there are many different BNs today. Yeah, and one doesn't know which BN will actually end up in power. So it's almost like maybe 2-3 step election.
Folks voted, I guess, in the election that gave rise to Pakatan Harapan for what they perceived to be hope, to be change, to be basically a reform or revamping to the system. Few years down the line, they were disillusioned, only to find that they were indeed, in many ways, the expectations fell short. And there was a lot of politicking, intrigue going on that fateful evening in early 2020 that culminated at the end to Pakatan Harapan. In your view, Nazir, what do you think brought about the demise or that dissolution of that state of government? Was it internal political factionalism? Was it mistrust from the people? Was it the pandemic, which was, I guess, not really a thing then, if at all, because it was February 2020. What were the causes behind that spectacular infraction and also splintering?
It was a coalition based on a common enemy. And I think there were many dubious assumptions in that coalition. Not least of all, how will Mahathir hand over to Anwar?
Yeah.
I mean, it's difficult to believe. I always found that odd because given what he said about Anwar, do you really believe he's going to hand over to Anwar? So I didn't think that was going to happen. But it was more than that. It was also within them. They never sat down. I mean, Mahathir very quickly said, oh, I didn't read the whole manifesto. Or I agreed. Then he said, I agreed to it because I didn't think we would win. I mean, come on. You can't do that. Right? You were the leader of this coalition. You had a manifesto, and very quickly said, "No. I didn't read it. You know, or I don't believe what's in it." I mean, that's really conning the electorate, right? So ultimately, within that coalition, it was irresponsible not to sit down and agree the fundamentals of partnership. Yeah, a viable, a sustainable, and viable partnership. It was irresponsible, and because you basically you gave people such huge hope and expectations, and having, I think it's worse. You know, sometimes when you give people hope and expectations, and then you disappoint them, it's worse than not doing it in the first place. Right, because a lot of people really felt that, you
That's
know,
right.
even I felt,
yeah.
right, that Malaysia is, you know, I was advocating this, you know, citizens assembly, blah, blah, blah. But when I saw the Pakatan manifesto, I'm like, I don't need it. Right, it's all in this manifesto.
Yeah.
So when Pakatan wins, it's fine. We're going to, you know, there's going to be a new Malaysia. That's what they said. But instead, very quickly, it was powerful segments of Pakatan just wanted to go back to the old Malaysia. The older Malaysia,
mm-hmm.
you know, the sort of 1990s Malaysia. And 1990s, if you read my book, was a bad time.
Yeah.
Right? We could we look back and we had very high economic growth, blah blah blah, but that was a precursor to the crisis.
Yeah.
And Malaysia was much more damaged in the crisis than Hong Kong, Singapore, etc., because of the excesses of the 90s. Yeah, so it's wrong to look at the 1990s as a good time. You know, anybody could have done well in the 1990s. You open up, so much capital came in, you got lots of money, you push.
Yeah.
You know, you look really good, right? And so that is a fundamental thing to understand. The 1990s was not a good time, and actually, Pakatan Harapan's leadership wanted to go back to the 1990s. Mm. And in that process, you also look at how they handled business, you know, whereas Nelson Mandela comes out of prison and embraces his jailers,
yeah,
and his opponents, whereas the Pakatan came in and were very, very vindictive.
Yeah.
They were angry people. They started sacking people from the GLCs, from the civil service, you know, anyone who had anything to do with, remotely to do with Barisan was treated as suspect, etc. Malaysia doesn't have enough people, doesn't have enough bright people to go and shun a whole cadre of people like that. To be fair, it's not all of Pakatan,
mm,
yeah, but they just went in, everyone just, you know, we just want to get rid of Najib, let's all come together. And when you get rid of it, it was like, okay, what are we going to do? Then nobody was in control.
Yeah.
And everyone just went in their own directions, and it was mayhem.
Hasn't this always been the case, though, with respect to, you know, this coalition of unwilling and of also fragmented but seemingly coalescent interests? Has that always been a norm in Malaysian politics, though? Especially, you know, when Tun Mahathir first came to power, he too came out of a process that basically played him against the likes of, say, Musa and whatnot within UMNO, in terms of the factions that existed, where some were more aggressive, some were more passive, but ultimately there was a lot of mistrust going on, even in the 1980s, 1970s.
Well, that's normal internal party politics,
right?
Right? And, you know, that's within UMNO. You didn't, you know, come in with this new beginning of a new nation, almost. Open up horizons, create new expectations. That, I think, is tragic. I think history is going to be very unkind on PH, because the first government, the first change of government comes with huge responsibilities.
Mm.
Right? Because PH then kind of established the norm, what you can do when you change government. Subsequent governments basically just said, hey, PH did it.
Mm.
Right? Imagine when PH came in, they basically sacked me and all the other GLC heads and all that, right? So when PN came in, then, you know, there were people saying, PH did that, you've got to sack all these people and give it to us now, right? So PH set the formula for changing government, and they set a very bad one, and Malaysia's going to pay for it.
It was a victory for the first time in history of a so-called non-establishment or incumbent government, right? The election was pivotal in that sense, but it was also in some ways, I guess, non-pivotal in that the main leaders and spearheaders of the PH ultimately came out of UMNO, and it came out of the original governing coalition. So I guess the question I have here is, can Malaysia transition towards a state of multi-party democracy where the opposition or the coalition of the opposition is truly evolutionarily, or, you know, by origin standards, independent and untethered from the incumbent UMNO sort of establishment that has persisted for decades in a country?
In theory, yes. In theory. I think you've seen people gaining political prominence, Malays gaining political prominence without having been through the UMNO. So in theory, yes. But ultimately, you know, the way forwards for Malaysia is, to me, a national reset. Without a reset, I think it's going to be very, very difficult to see us progress well.
And you see the multiple parties right now, you know, wanting to push for this, angling for this national reset as potentially viable.
Some of the smaller parties are,
okay,
are pro-reset. I guess, you know, that's the law, right? They've got nothing to lose, whereas the incumbents have much to lose, so they don't want to reset. But, you know, I would like to take everyone step back and say, let's say, let's really ask each other, what does the nation need? It's not what about what you need. It's about what, not what your constituents, what Malaysia really needs. And it really needs a reset.
I think these are the great ideals, and I think the practice and the implementation of that is where the devil will lie. But on a more reflective note, what would you say are the greatest achievements and failures thus far in your life? And you obviously have, you know, many more years to come, but so far in your life, what do you think are the biggest setbacks and the biggest successes that you can lay claim to?
I mean, it's kind of in the book, I suppose, you know, the whole Siamese story is something, you know, it's a legacy, it's something that I'm very proud of. And, you know, I guess, so far, within that CIMB legacy, there's stuff I wish I did better. But overall, you know, I think, you know, you look at a 30-year career, it's a net basis, right? It's the pluses and minuses. I think much more, the pluses are humongously larger than the negatives.
The IPO, for instance, was probably one that you still come to lament.
Well, I mean, I fixed it.
Yes.
I fixed it, didn't go well, meaning I fixed it. And, you know, maybe some acquisitions didn't go as well as I thought, blah, 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 blah. Those are some, you know, I think. And I suppose if you look at the reset agenda, if you like, that so far has not taken off the ground. Right, and that continues. That's a big frustration of mine, because, you know, I've been harping on this since 2015.
Yeah. What do you think are the main bottlenecks holding you back there?
Well, I think there just isn't enough momentum and support for it, and there's huge resistance to it. And maybe, you know, it's naive of me to think that, you know, I can just convince people, right? Maybe I need to be a proper movement for national reset, rather than just try and rely on existing politicians and political parties to take on my cause.
That's very fair. And as we come on to the penultimate question for today, I do want to ask you a slightly, I guess, left-field question, Nazir, if you will, concerning crypto finance. So obviously, you know, we've seen the advent of crypto and also Web 3.0 innovation at large as a means of transforming the way we do business, transactions, and finance at large. Now, as someone who's so steeped in experience in finance, what do you make of, you know, the rise of DeFi, decentralized finance, but also more broadly speaking, the leveraging of crypto and blockchain technology within finance and financial industries?
I think there is a role for DeFi. I think that the rise and crash is not unusual. You know, it's a bit like the dot-com boom and bust and kind of more sensible growth thereafter. I think you probably see that here as well. The boom bust is more severe because this is so borderless and unregulated, whereas the dot-com booms, you still kind of govern as corporations, etc. And this is actually DeFi and borderless. I think even as in with my own personal portfolio, there is room for cryptocurrencies, a small room, but I do think that the idea that you could have an asset that is whose value is democratically established, as opposed to subject to the vagaries of interest rate policies and currencies, etc., is an attractive idea. Of course, I look forward to them bringing more value, more usefulness to crypto.
Bitcoin or Ethereum?
Bitcoin or Ethereum, Bitcoin.
Okay, that's fair. And on the final question, because, you know, there's so many of our readers and audience that really, you know, enjoy reading, not just looking into, but also thinking about Malaysian politics and how reform is possible. How would you advise, Nazir, a young aspiring Malaysian student currently studying perhaps in the UK or studying abroad who wants to come back and change this country for the better? What's your advice to them? And what's your sort of, I guess, overarching tip and takeaway that you hope they can draw from your long and lustrous career?
Well, I think first thing is your country's always worth fighting for. And despite wastages, corruption, etc., that's gone on for many years, actually, Malaysia's in pretty good shape. And I think Malaysia has huge potential if we harness our competitive advantages, like our natural resources, our diversity, our geography. There are many things that we can do. So as a project, there can't be anything better than to come back and try and build a better country. Right? Then the question is, you don't want to start a project unless you think that it can be a success. But I think if more people come back and do it and believe in it, then I think, you know, there are enough platforms out there for you to jump on. And it's going to be very difficult to go back to the past where, you know, the government didn't tolerate these new political parties, etc. I think the new order is there, right? And I think that's a positive in recent years. I think, you know, freedom of speech is much more established now. And I think taking sides, you don't, being in the opposition or against government is much more acceptable today than it was, because we've had this change in government. So there's a lot of, there is some progress in Malaysian democracy, and there is more democratic spaces for the young today. I did a lot of work in Indonesia, and in the early 2000s, most thought, and I thought, Indonesia could well be a failed state. And look at it today. Yeah, it is a beacon of democracy, and it's got most of the unicorns in the region.
Mm.
And when you go there, you hang around with the young people. They are so inspirational, and they are so at ease with themselves. And I believe that Malaysia needs to be young again. Yeah, I always reflect on the past when we had chief of police was 33 years old, chief of navy was 29 years old. I mean, Malaysia used to rely on the young in its early successful days. Today, somehow or other, Malaysia became very old. We need to be young again, and we can be young again if enough bright young people come back and ask for their space. And, you know, one of the things I've been pushing very hard on is the idea that we should maybe even intervene to say that every board, company board, should have a young person on it. You know, we insist on having gender diversity. Why can't we have youth?
Age diversity.
And why not say, okay, you must always have someone between 28 to 32, right? And then it's a rolling thing, right? But at least, you know, you give young experience. And the flip side is actually, because of the generational gap today, I think the old people can learn a lot from the young in terms of technology, in terms of social media, etc. And I think, you know, it's a win-win.
And it is on that note, on that very hopeful note, that I hope indeed that more of you would come back to Malaysia. And it's been an absolute honour and privilege to have with us here, Nazir Razak. Thank you so, so much for your time. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you. Just going to stop the recording. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Good to see you.
I hope you enjoyed the interview. I certainly did.